from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny, editor emeritus and national correspondent for Harper's Magazine and founder and editor of Lapham's Quarterly. Louis Lapham will join us in the studio for the hour ahead, and we'll discuss with him the future of education and why he believes we need to recast our ideas of what an education can and should do, as well as reformulate how democratic ideals associated with education can and must be achieved. Louis Lapham, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum program. In this Forum hour, we're joined by an old friend here in studio and a former San Franciscan veteran writer, commentator, thinker, editor, and educator, Louis Lapham, who for many years was editor of Harper's Magazine, where he continues to serve as national correspondent. He also now edits Lapham's Quarterly, which he founded. Louis Lapham has been writing on the subject of American education for years, most recently stating in a March 2009 article in Lapham's Quarterly that there are two invincible facts about American education in the 21st century, that the future rests with the promise of education and that that promise is not being kept. Louis Lapham joins us in the second hour, and delighted to have you here with us again. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael. I'm very glad to be here.
Well, let's go right to it on education. I want to talk with you about the Quarterly and a whole range of things I hope we can touch on in the course of this hour and hear from listeners, of course, as well. But education as a commodity, because you talk about how that's a notion that really needs to be retired, that you pour it into an empty vessel. And you begin with Plutarch saying the mind is not a vessel to be filled, but a fire to be kindled. And I guess the real question comes down to, how do we kindle? How do we best kindle?
Well, the first thing we do is pay our teachers more, and we begin to understand teachers as one of our most precious, if not the most precious, of our natural resources. And we should treat them that way. Also, I think we should there are all kinds of different approaches to curriculum, but again, I would try to leave the decision making as to what goes on in the classroom to the teacher rather than to a set testing to a standard that is in many ways impossible to reach. For example, I happen to think that history is a primary way to learn, and that I agree with the late Arthur Schlesinger that history is an antidote to folly, or I agree with Cicero, who says that not to know what happened before one was born is always to be a child. And without a sense of history, what happened 3 weeks ago or 30 years ago or 300 years ago puts you at the mercy of the dealers in fascist politics and quack religion. And Schlesinger thought that unless Americans had an understanding of their history, they were likely to lose not only their hope of individual liberty, but also the practice of democratic self-government. And I have that kind of feeling about history. When I started out in life, when I left college long, long ago, I thought I would become an historian. I became a journalist instead. But this new quarterly venture that I've undertaken is a return to my first enthusiasm.
Well, the quarterly venture actually, I mean, just now quoting Schlesinger and Socrates, and Cicero, and I brought in Plutarch because you bring in Plutarch. It's a compendium of some of those great historical quotes. And with respect to education, in one of the quarterlies, you begin with H.G. Wells saying human history has become more and more a race between education and catastrophe.
Right.
So we need a revolution in education, is what you wrote about. Pretty
yes,
much.
I do. And a renaissance. I mean, there have been points in time when education has been very, very good in this country. As you well know, in California in the 30s and the 40s, it was probably the best educational system in the country. And I'm old enough to actually remember that. And the founders of the country were passionate about education. It's a subject that Jefferson comes back to continually. So does Franklin. And if you read some of the examinations that kids were given in Salina, Kansas, in the 1890s, it's astonishing what they were being asked to read. And so, but to do that on a large scale is difficult. And I remind you of what happens in 1909 when Woodrow Wilson was president of Princeton University before he becomes governor of New Jersey and before he becomes president of the United States. He gives a speech to the Teachers Association of the state of New York, and he says, what we want in this country are two classes of people. One, necessarily a very small class of people to whom we will give a liberal education, and two, a necessarily much larger class of people who we will to whom we will assign the difficult tasks of manual labor.
Maybe we've become too egalitarian in our desire to educate everybody, especially when we're talking about assigning and educating for manual labor, do you think?
Well, it depends what we teach. I mean, you can be awakened. I mean, a true education is in my opinion, which is Plutarch's, where he says that a mind is not a vessel to be filled but a fire to be kindled, is to awaken the student to the light and energy in his or her own mind. And that can be done in all kinds of ways. I mean, that can be done pruning a tree, dissecting a frog. It can be a craft. It can be mathematics. It can be the sciences. It doesn't necessarily have to be the classical curriculum that we now give to kids. I mean, it's
what you call, the art of boredom and the science of diminished expectations.
Yeah, right. That's what we do in our public, many of our public schools, and even in some of our private schools.
You also make the argument that we have to alter the conceptions of America as the sum of its GDP. So education has really become so commodified. I'm looking at actually what an eighth grade final exam from the late 1800s, since you were referencing before the way education used to be. Give 9 rules for the use of capital letters. Name the parts of speech and define those that have no modifications. Define verse, stanza, and paragraph. What are the principal parts of a verb? Give principal parts of lie, lay, and run. Define case. Illustrate each case. What is punctuation? Give rules for principal marks of punctuation. A lot of this is rote, though. A lot of this is not necessarily going to light up the mind.
Well, yes, but I mean, it's like, again, there are parts of education that are rote and then parts of lighting up in the mind. And it's the quality of the teacher that manages to combine those two elements. In other words, if you want to play the piano, you have to do a certain amount of scales. There is a certain amount of rote. You need some kind of knowledge before you can have the excitement of further knowledge. It's building blocks. It's like making Lego toys.
It's like the kind of teaching you got at town school with Mr. Mulholland, I think was his name.
I did, Mr. Charles Mulholland. I was very lucky. I think any young person is lucky to encounter an exciting teacher. And I did that in the 6th, 7th, and 8th grade at the town school in San Francisco on the corner of Scott and Jackson Streets.
Can you mention your pedigree for a moment? Because your grandfather was mayor of San Francisco.
My grandfather was mayor of San Francisco, yes, between 1940, 1944 and 1940, or 1942 and 46, I think, is right, yeah. And so he was the mayor of San Francisco, and we had a we were in the shipping business. And I was here during World War II as a young boy, and that was very dramatic and exciting. And I was also here because my grandfather was mayor. He presided over the chartering of the UN at the Opera House in the spring of 1945. And I was excused from school to attend the plenary sessions.
Including Mr. Mulholland's class?
Including Mr. Mulholland's class. He allowed me out. But Mr. Mulholland could make history vivid. He would take a whole week on the Battle of Cannae, or a whole 2 weeks on the Cortez seizing the Mexico City from Montezuma and the Aztecs. And he would draw maps on the board, and he would bring to life the elements of the Roman Republic or the American Republic. And he gave it such vivid expression that it was a constant excitement.
I remember Gore Vidal once saying to me in an interview many, many years ago, it takes a certain talent to make history dull and boring, but there are so many who unfortunately have that talent.
Yeah.
And we get into just the whole element here of not only pedagogy, but talent and vitality and excitement. And George Leonard, late George Leonard, was a friend of mine, talked about education and ecstasy. I mean, inspiring has to do with being ecstatic almost, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And the again, I think of Pablo Casals. Pablo Casals is 93 years old, and he's living in Puerto Rico with a woman much younger than himself, and a reporter from New York goes down and says to him, "Mr. Casals, you're the most famous cellist in the world. You're living here in the sun, at ease. You're not performing on the concert stage anymore. Why do you practice the cello every morning for 4 hours?" And Casals said, "Because I'm learning something." And to me, that's the that is an endorphin high. I mean, when the mind is being actively engaged and creatively employed, it's like an athlete being in the zone. I mean, it is close to ecstasy. It can be that. And again, you read in the newspapers about the current problems of American education, and you hear people saying, politicians as well as columnists, what a selfish, ragged, terrible group of people teachers are. I mean, that's part of the conversation. They get paid too much, they're lazy, and so forth and so on. But rather than talking about teachers as an admired group of people, I mean, you know, certainly on the level of professional ball players, I mean, they in the current conversation, they tend to be downgraded and regarded as slackers, and that's just
well, there are some bad apples that make it.
Well, there are, but there are also some bad apples on the ball field.
I think the problem now, though, has to do with things like collective bargaining and, you know, the governor of Wisconsin saying teachers have to essentially conform to how we provide the dictums for them to conform. I mean, it's an economic issue. It's been made into an economic issue.
It's true. But again, to me, that's another question of priority. We don't invest enough money in education, where that money should be invested is in labor, I mean, in the teacher rather than in, and therefore in the size of the classroom rather than in the technology.
Talking to Lewis Lapham, who is now the head of Lapham's Quarterly, and we'll talk about Lapham's Quarterly as well, but you talk in one of Lapham's Quarterlies about educated citizens as being kind of an absurd notion. What do you mean?
What I mean is that education is an ongoing process. I can think of a self-educating citizen, and I've had the good fortune to know quite a few of those people, among them yourself. But if you go, let's say, the usual grammar school, high school, college, you've spent roughly the equivalent of something like, I'm sorry, 47 months in a classroom, and the people that continue after that to learn wouldn't themselves say that they were educated. They were saying they were getting there. They were learning something. I think of the Japanese painter Hokusai, who at the age of 80 said that since I was a child I've been mad about painting. And he goes through a long set. By the time I was 50 and by the time I was 60 and so on, he said, now I am 75 and I think I'm on the edge of learning how to do it. And by the time I'm 100, everything I draw, whether it be a dot or a line, will be alive. So it's that attitude. And again, the Americans are good at this. I mean, the idea of self-improvement, if you remember the five-foot shelf and the collections of the great books, the canon of Western civilization put together by Hudgens at the University of Chicago, by the Encyclopedia Britannica. These things used to be staple book sales. And what you could say about Lapham's Quarterly is it's the great books made topical and abbreviated, because, again, that you can't help, because that's a product of the passing of time. I mean, we now, the articles in newspapers that in magazines that used to be 4,000 words are now 750-page 750-word op-ed pieces. And you know, what used to be a column is now a tweet.
Well, the wonderful thing that I like and admire in Lapham's Quarterly is the way it provides a compendium of the current state of ideas, takes themes like the city or celebrity or education and brings in this whole sweep of history and many of the things that have been said by the greatest minds of our time. And you're getting a good deal of testament to that. You have the SEEDS director of education in New Jersey now saying we're using it for young people, and particularly young people who are disadvantaged. And I know that means a lot to you. How relevant, though, in a world of tweets, how relevant is something like Lapham's Quarterly or Harper's or The New Yorker? Are we getting new ideas being born for democracy's sake, or is there just more homogenization and distilling of ideas with the kind of technology we see?
Well, again, I think we're not talking about mass market, and we're not talking about big time television ratings, and we're not talking about influencing policy. On the other hand, we are seeding the ground. In other words, trying to impart, at least what I'm trying to do with a quarterly, has got a circulation of 26,000, something like that. And which
may be a lot of the choir. I mean, I'm wondering if kids who watch Jersey Shores are reading Lapham's Quarterly.
No, I don't think they are. But the again, go to a high-end college like, let's say, Yale or Stanford. And what's true is that it's a smaller proportion than you would think, let's say 15-20%, are kids that are determined to get an education and will exploit all of the assets that those universities offer. But for them to really come away with what I would regard as an awakened mind is going to require their active search for that. So that, yes, I mean, the large part of humanity has always been lazy and passive and prefer entertainment. And the greatest entertainment in America in the middle of the 19th century were public hangings. So, yeah, I mean,
sobering thought, but a real one.
Yeah.
It also brings up a related question about the concern for the humanities in this age of technology. You talk at one point about they're being viewed almost as exquisite ornaments, kept up like the house in Southampton and a season subscription to the Met Opera. But you also say that that humanistic pursuits is really the passion of thought and the will to understand. And we currently seem to have a devaluation of the humanities and of the arts. But you also point out that many of our founding fathers seem to devalue them. I don't get into this founding fathers thing, but they, I mean, you kind of caught my eye talking about Jefferson and Franklin as saying some things that were off-putting where the arts are concerned.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, Franklin writes a letter to, or he answers opinions that are being floated around London in the 1780s. And so he writes a piece, a broadside, on informing Europeans, particularly people in England, what kind of people would be welcome in America. And what he says, he wants people who can do something useful. He doesn't want artists. He wants what the country needs are carpenters or blacksmiths or people who know how to sail ships or build fences or dig canals, make things. It's a very empirical approach, which is also in line with what is being said by the great French encyclopedia in the same, you know, the same latter half of the 18th century, Diderot and D'Holbach and those people. It's filled not just with philosophical paragraphs, but also describing how things work, the arts, the crafts, the uses of reason as applied to the making of things. The notion that man is a machine that through reason, science, discovery, exploration, tinkering, whether with clocks or electricity or firing pins, will improve the common lot and lead to the pursuit of happiness. So what Franklin is saying is first things first.
He's being reasonably pragmatic, I could say.
Yes, yes, he is.
We're coming up on a break. I want to give out the phone number and invite listeners. Some real questions here. The rising tide of mediocrity continues to rise, essentially, is what Lewis Lapham says. And what can be done to stave off that, not as Yeats called, blood-dimmed tide, but nevertheless serious tide? And how do you feel about the future of education? What needs to be done, particularly with respect to the arts and the humanities? Feel free to join us. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Join us now if you care to, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Lewis Lapham, who is founder and editor of Lapham's Quarterly and also was for many years editor of Harper's Magazine, over 25 years, author of numerous works concerning politics and current affairs. And Lapham's Quarterly is his new baby, so to speak. He's the founder and editor of that. And as I said earlier on, it is a remarkable compression of ideas related to specific themes. We're talking for the most part about education. We're actually going to be talking about education on Saturday as a benefit for Waldorf School at the Jewish Community Center in San Francisco at 2 o'clock. And Lewis Lapham and I will be there to pursue some of these ideas in greater depth and detail. talking about really how we can reform, best reform education. We started talking about the need for more history, the need for more humanities came up toward the end of that first half hour, teachers being treated more professionally, changing the curriculum, all of those kinds of things, but particularly lighting up minds and kindling minds and making young people find the things that interest them the most and excite them the most. Here's an email from someone named Don who says, I grew up in Connecticut but never knew anyone educated at Hotchkiss School. That institution seems to have a list of distinguished alumni in many fields that is out of proportion to its enrollment. Two questions. How much of this can be explained by the contacts one makes at school like that, at a school like that? And two, what did you learn there that you've wanted to see taught in public schools? And thank you for the many wonderful years of Harper's.
Well, when I was at the Hotchkiss School, the soul of the school was the headmaster, a man named George Van Sanford, who is truly one of the, you know, the great teachers of the century. He was had been classically educated. He had all kinds of things. He had a magnificent memory, and he could quote in Latin and Greek. But he, as well as having a mastery of the classical studies, he'd also read he'd served with distinction in World War I. He was a horseman. He kept bees. He'd been born on a farm in upstate Troy, New York, in the late part of the 19th century.
So it was more the headmaster than the kids that you...
Well, I mean, the headmaster gave the kind of set the tone of the school.
Trickled down from him?
Yeah, it's kind of a trickle down, and there were all... He set a very high standard. He took learning very seriously, and he had assembled... By the time that I went to Hotchkiss was in the 50s, he'd been the headmaster for 20 years, and he had assembled a very fine company of prep school teachers. So there were a lot. I had a magnificent English teacher. I had Mulholland. I was lucky to have Mulholland when I was here in San Francisco. But at the Hotchkiss School, I had an English teacher named Carl Parsons, who taught me to value the meaning of words and made me appreciate the uses of syntax and grammar, and also was eager to give me all kinds of books to read. I mean, I was reading Joseph Conrad as well as Sherlock Holmes, but it was they were fun to read.
And this was mentoring, really, wasn't it? Although I'm curious to know if you find that kind of classroom teaching and mentoring more valuable when it's what they call student-centered. The ideas often come from the student. The student just expresses his or her needs, and the teacher kind of follows suit. Or should it come more directly from the pedagogue, the teacher in front of
class? No, I think student-centered. Let me give you a very good example. I went from Yale University to Cambridge, England, and it was extremely different. The English have the tutorial system, so that I was studying, my field was medieval English history, and there was going to be an examination in the spring, but it was not going to be given by my tutor. The examinations were given by a sort of circuit examiners, like circuit judges. They would come into town and they would give the examination, so that the relation between the tutor and the student was that of a coach and an athlete. He was trying to prepare me for what was coming, which he didn't know. So I wasn't having to prove to him how smart I was. He was trying to, he'd say to, and all the lectures were optional. He'd say, well, why don't you go and hear Plum and see what Plum has to say? And I'd go over and I'd go to a couple of lectures by Plum, and then I'd come back and talk to my tutor. And he'd say, well, what do you think? And I said, I liked them or I didn't. And he said, well, then try Leavis. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
And or he'd say, read this. And I had to write for him. The tutorial was formal, and usually with tea was served in front of a coals burning in an ancient grate. And I would have to present a paper. I'd write something. But there was no mark on it. I mean, he'd read it in my presence, comment on its structure and use of language, usually inadequate, and then throw it in the fire. I mean, there was no grade. I wasn't competing for a number. I mean, it didn't have that kind of pressure.
Do you think that pressure is bad, letter grades and the kind of competition that goes on for letters?
I think it gets to be because a couple of years ago, you know, in the 80s, I taught a course at Yale on nonfiction writing, and I taught it actually for credit. It wasn't one of those visiting dignitary seminar sort of things. But this was for a real mark, and I find that it was very upsetting to the kids because they were trying to compose good-looking resume, you know, and it mattered to them a great deal as to exactly whether they got an A or a B or a C. And I gave some marks that were not, you know, that were down in the C range. And one of the members of the English department said, you know, we just, you've got it. We don't want to do this. You know, I mean, these are bright kids, and they deserve better marks. Right? It's what they've come for. I mean, there's a lot of grade inflation in a number of our schools and universities now because of the competition and because it's the degree is a credential, a ticket of admission to the higher things in life.
Well, it's part of the union card. I think actually you point out at one point that maybe one of the mistakes in education is that an education ought to be leading to more greater prosperity or the prospects of more money in the bank or something along those
lines.
Yeah,
you're right. It's like a union card. It's like a credential, and you have to remember that Lincoln didn't go to school. Neither did Benjamin Franklin. Neither did Ezra Pound or Thomas Edison. I mean, and even in the before World War II, relatively few young Americans went to college, or certainly to the so-called, you know, the private schools, and people that were hiring in Wall Street in the 20s and the 30s and even into the 40s did not want college kids. College kids were looked down on. They wanted a kid who had started as an apprentice on the floor of the stock exchange, probably at the age of 14, and had learned the game and had worked himself, you know, knew the business. I mean, the whole idea of the college education as a credential, as an entry, as a ticket to a higher income and a white-collar job comes after World War II.
I can still remember when I went off to college, and it was really a big deal to think of, you know, getting a college education.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I came from a working class background, and there were a lot of people who weren't, the generation before.
Yeah.
It was the ticket to a future. It meant in their minds the ticket to a future, and it meant something very, very big indeed.
Yeah.
Let me bring our callers into this. And Adam, you're first up. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. Great conversation. I find just value in this conversation alone as education. But my question is generally about public education, especially early on childhood. I always wondered why getting a degree in philosophy, and the only reason for my pursuit in going to college was that I found the subject of philosophy, why it's not introduced in early education, first, second, third grade. You know, I've heard pockets in England, they're trying to do stuff like this, but just introducing the subject of thinking itself into early education as a form of curriculum change to me seems valuable, and I wonder why that's not pursued in American education today.
I don't know the answer to that question. Do you, Michael?
No. But, you know, people say not only about philosophy being a part of earlier education, they want young people to learn about banking and economics. We used to, in fact, have a bank book that we would bring to our public school and make deposits because of the sense of not enough literacy about, well, so many different subjects, philosophy being one of them, and certainly one case in point.
I'll give you another case in point. Have you heard of something, or maybe the caller has heard of something, of United World Colleges?
I have heard of them, yeah.
Well, so that you know what that is. These are colleges, I think there are, 13 or 14 of them now, and they're in different parts of the world. And they it's a two-year course for students that have had no privileges in life, and they take them from all over the world. I mean, they take and each cohort is 200 kids, and they try to have at least 100 countries represented. And they have these schools. There's one I've been at, the one in Vancouver up the coast, but they have them. There's one in India, there's one in Ireland, I'm sorry, there's one in Wales, Italy, there's one in the United States, and I think it's in Arizona. But they approach the problem of education. They're trying to prepare these kids who essentially have had no, not much of an education, but are bright. You know, they, in an interview, they can see that they're intelligent and they're curious and they want to learn. And what they're teaching them, they're trying to give them in 2 years enough to get into major universities around the world. And they approach it the way the caller mentioned. It's epistemology. It's how do we know what we think we know? On the basis of what? On the basis of faith? On the basis of evidence? On the basis of our own emotion? And that's the way they present subjects.
They've had some pretty good results, too.
And it's had very good results.
Yeah. Let me get another caller. Lori, thank you for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. I was also in high school in the 60s, and I had the lucky opportunity of going to a progressive high school for a year and a half, and we had amazing classes, poetry and Shakespeare and ecology, blah, blah, blah. Went overseas for a year in a British school, and again, loaded with excellent curriculum, you know, biology and physics and chemistry and history. I came back to finish up my last year and a half of high school at a regular, supposedly good, decent American high school, and taking the good teachers, and found the whole thing was dumbed down, that very little was expected of me. So, for instance, I had an international relations class with one of the better teachers, and you think we could talk about North, South, East, West, communism. Instead, we're making mobiles. And I just think so little is expected of American students throughout the education experience that it's, I think a lot more could be expected.
Okay.
So I'd love your feedback on that.
Thank you for that statement, Lori. Lewis Lapham?
Well, I think she's right. I can remember during my years as editor of the magazine, I got a letter from a woman who wrote and said, most of the problems that we have in the United States can be reduced to the proposition that we don't expect enough of ourselves and don't ask enough of we set our standard too low. And part of the reason for that, of course, is political, because we're trying to – the idea of – the American education is a very noble, romantic idea. We're trying to do for our children what we couldn't do for ourselves. And we're trying to do everything for everybody. And
That's the egalitarianism I was talking about before.
Yeah, but in order to do that, you have to bring down the denomination. I mean, you have to lower
bring down the standards.
You have to bring down the standard, yeah.
On point here, here's Debbie who writes, I work at a community college. Many young people have trouble focusing on getting an education. Why can't our society find something else for them to do, like public works projects, until they become 25? The students in their middle 20s and beyond are far more serious. Maybe give priority and financial aid to people over 25. Sounds prejudiced, but the problem with young people is that they don't have the maturity, and they do have the energy, both prevent them from sitting still and concentrating. Another listener writes, it's great that this program is discussing the shortcomings of our curriculum teachers, but are we missing the most important ingredient in sparking Plutarch's fire of the mind? The parents. What should we as a society be doing to encourage and enable parents to raise the most intelligent, best-equipped children possible? Much research indicates that 90% of a child's intelligence and personality are formed in the first 36 months of life. Certainly got a point. Another listener, Vincent, writes, I was fortunate enough to have been grounded to my room for a summer, and in that summer I read the Book of Knowledge and the Britannic Encyclopedia cover to cover. From that experience, I've become the person that I am. I no longer think of what got me confined to my room, but I think of all that I learned. And some specific questions. Here's Mark, who says, does Mr. Lapham think of himself as primarily optimistic or pessimistic regarding the trajectory of American society? In his most recent Harper's piece, he seems to identify quite strongly with Mark Twain in expressing cynicism about our human tendency to self-deception and general inclination toward the ignoble. I did happen to read that piece, and I think I think he's right in terms of what you were saying.
That was Twain's conclusion. Twain, toward the end of his life, begins to talk about what he calls the damned human race, and he is in his early writing, and as a young man, he's extremely optimistic about what can be made of the United States. I mean, again, it's in the middle of the 19th century. He's born in 1835, and the 1840s and 50s in America are a period of enormous invention and discovery. People are inventing machinery. They're opening new lands. They're building schools on both banks of the Mississippi River. There, Twain was later in the century absolutely enchanted with the notion of electric light, and his vision of what could be done, and part of this shows up in his novel, the Connecticut Yankee at King Arthur's court. And the point of that novel is that despite the wonders of, the Enlightenment and the age of discovery and science, and whatever the Connecticut Yankee tries to do to bring the enslaved serfs out of their misery in medieval England, it fails because human nature, the instinct for self-deception, joyful descent into ignorance and superstition overwhelms the Connecticut Yankee at the end of the novel. And that is a position that Twain had reached at the end of his life, and his writing gets darker and darker.
Well, he was a pretty bitter man. I mean, with the inventions, with the loss of
he has a lot of
wife and child tragedies in his home.
Yes, his wife dies, and two of his daughters die.
But you, don't share that pessimism, do you? I don't.
No,
think.
I don't. Again, he retains his enormous affection for individuals. It's the human race collectively, en masse, that of which he despairs. But you read his autobiography and you see the letters that he's writing to people, that the services that he performs, the concern, the empathy that it's why he's a great novelist, because he can get into the minds of other people. And I would say that he's a skeptic, but I don't think he's a cynic. I don't think he gives up.
Not on the individual level, you're saying.
No, yeah. And also his satire, you see, is humor sent on a moral errand. It's got a purpose. His wit can be ferocious, but what he means to do with it is to burn down the hospitality tents of what he calls the world's colossal humbug. And he means to draw blood with his satire, right?
And he does.
But some of our own satirists don't. They simply mean to wound and not to strike.
Here's Chris who writes, "My dad, Colin Wilcox, was a teacher at town school in the 50s, and he was always so proud to follow the success of Lewis Lapham and to have him as a student. Mr. Lapham should know that not only do teachers have effects on students, but students, too, can have long-lasting effects on their teachers."
Oh, that's really nice to know. I didn't know that.
What do you make of the increasingly, Pierre writes, bleak job market for humanities graduate students upon completion of their dissertations? Do you see the humanities as a field already undervalued by comparison to other university departments, science and engineering, suffering even more as a result of the recent economic downturn? As a recent college graduate who is interested in pursuing doctoral work in European history, I've recently decided to pursue alternative career options instead of taking on the immense student loan burden and existential uncertainty that another 7 years of study may present, both exacerbated by the increasingly bleak chance of finding a good job opportunity after completing my PhD.
Well, I'm deeply sympathetic to that caller. I was just 3 weeks ago, I was down in Las Vegas at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas to try to give a fight speech to the in defense of the humanities and about the necessity of the humanities. You see, the humanities are a necessity. They're not a luxury. I mean, as you say, we tend to present them as precious ornaments to be preserved in the vault together with the university's endowment. But without our technologies find continuously improved means toward increasingly ill-defined ends. And if we don't know what we're making or why or where to point the digital enhancements, we're likely to murder ourselves with our own toys. And so you can think of the sciences as the House of Representatives, and think of the humanities as the Senate.
I like that. As a member of the humanities, I think of myself as a lord, like the higher house in England. John from Belvedere, join us. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to say hello to Lou Lapham, John Scarborough.
Hi, John.
I was listening to the radio program and heard you mention Mr. Mulholland at town school, and I've often told friends that he was the best teacher I ever had in my whole life, and I was thrilled to hear his name come up on the radio. I also remember, Lou, what a good pitcher you were, in the baseball pitcher in the eighth grade.
Thank you for telling me that, John. I'm glad to hear your voice.
Did you have a slider?
I don't think so. No.
Okay. He had a fastball, is all I remember. Nobody could hit it.
John, good to hear from you. Thank you for that call. I want to hear next from Mark in Dublin. Good morning, Mark.
Morning. Yeah, we actually played town school in baseball. I almost went there in 1970. I wound up going to Head Royce instead. But it would have been an interesting commute for me from Oakland. 1970 was also a year that I had a very revelatory experience when I went to Europe and visited family members there for the first time and was amazed and somewhat embarrassed by the fact that I had a 12- and a 15-year-old cousin who both spoke fluent English. And they both, you know, were Germans living in Germany, and I could maybe get out a few words of English. And this was, I think, a tremendous advantage of the European educational system at the time.
Mark, you know the old line, someone who speaks three languages is trilingual, someone who speaks two is bilingual, and someone who speaks one is American.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
And even at this point, I consider myself to be, you know, a fairly accomplished person. I mean, I have a doctorate, and I've been to, you know, like four of the best universities in the United States. And I can speak, you know, bad French, bad German, bad Hebrew, bad Spanish. Actually, you know, reasonably competently, but not at the level where my European cousins can. And I just wonder how, and I think I'm not atypical in this sense. I think I'm actually probably better linguistically than most Americans who don't have, English as a second language. And I just wonder how we're going to be able to compete in the world economy these days, where knowledge is such a premium.
Well, he has a point.
Yeah, very good point. It's why a lot of people I know are seeing to it who have young children that their children are learning Chinese. Apropos of the last hour with Joe Nye.
Yeah.
And thank you for that call. Here's a listener says, I was very moved by Mr. Lapham's essay in Harper's calling for a general strike. It expressed everything I felt and so much more, a truly inspirational call to action. My question for Mr. Lapham is this: do you think we still need a general strike? And what do you think it would take to motivate this populace to a general strike? We've got just seconds left, unfortunately.
Well, I thought it was a good sign in Wisconsin. I mean, that's a step in the right direction. I mean, if the more people that wake up to the fact that the government currently in Washington, or that the American oligarchy, the government is to say, it seems to be fairly nonpartisan, but I mean the government of the country is in the hands at the moment of an oligarchy that shares the view of Voltaire, which is the comfort of the rich depends upon an abundant supply of the poor. And as long as that policy is continued, and as people begin to figure that out on both the left and the right, that you might begin to see more revolutionary movement.
Well, that's a good note to end on. Always a pleasure to have you. Louis Lapham, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And again, I would recommend Lapham's Quarterly to those of you who love knowledge. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Remind you that I'll be with Louis Lapham, interviewing him at the Jewish Community Center in San Francisco at 2 on the 26th. Our producers are Kevin Guillory and Christina Russo. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.